Part 3. Chapter 19. The Tunnel. Imagine you're entering a tunnel. Imagine the perspective. As you look down the length that stretches ahead of you, notice how the walls seem to narrow to the tiny dot of light at the other end. The light at the end of the tunnel is a symbol of hope, and it's also what people say they see in near-death experiences. They have to go to it, they say. They're drawn to it. But then, where else is there to go in a tunnel except through it? Hasn't everything led up to that point? My tunnel was the tunnel, an enormous Pearl Harbor-era airplane factory turned NSA facility located under a pineapple field in Cunia on the island of Oahu, Hawaii. The facility was built out of reinforced concrete, its eponymous tunnel a kilometer-long tube in the side of a hill opening up into three cavernous floors of server vaults and offices. At the time the tunnel was built, the hill was covered over with huge amounts of sand, soil, desiccated pineapple plant leaves, and patches of sun-parched grass to camouflage it from Japanese bombers. 60 years later, it resembled the vast burial mound of a lost civilization, or some gigantic arid pile that a weird god had heaped up in the middle of a god-sized sandbox. Its official name was the Cunia Regional Security Operations Center. I went to work there, still on a Dell contract, but now for the NSA again, in early 2012. One day that summer, actually it was my birthday, as I passed through the security checks and proceeded down the tunnel, it struck me. This, in front of me, was my future. I'm not saying that I made any decisions at that instant. The most important decisions in life are never made that way. They're made subconsciously and only express themselves consciously once fully formed, once you're finally strong enough to admit to yourself that this is what your conscience has already chosen for you. This is the course that your beliefs have decreed. That was my 29th birthday present to myself, the awareness that I had entered a tunnel that would narrow my life down toward a single, still indistinct act. Just as Hawaii had always been an important way station, historically, the U.S. military treated the island chain as little more than a mid-Pacific refueling depot for boats and planes. It had also become an important switch point for American communications. These include the intelligence that flowed between the contiguous 48 states and my former place of employment, Japan, as well as other sites in Asia. The job I'd taken was a significant step down the career ladder, with duties I could at this point perform in my sleep. It was supposed to mean less stress, a lighter burden. I was the sole employee of the aptly named Office of Information Sharing, where I worked as a SharePoint systems administrator. SharePoint is a Microsoft product, a dopey, pokey program, or rather a grab bag of programs, focused on internal document management, who can read what, who can edit what, who can send and receive what, and so on. By making me Hawaii's SharePoint systems administrator, the NSA had made me the manager of document management. I was, in effect, the reader-in-chief at one of the agency's most significant facilities. As was my typical practice in any new technical position, I spent the earliest days automating my tasks, meaning writing scripts to do my work for me, so as to free up my time for something more interesting. Before I go any further, I want to emphasize this. My active searching out of NSA abuses began not with the copying of documents, but with the reading of them. My initial intention was just to confirm the suspicions that I'd first had back in 2009 in Tokyo. 3 years later, I was determined to find out if an American system of mass surveillance existed, and if it did, how it functioned. Though I was uncertain about how to conduct this investigation, I was at least sure of this. I had to understand exactly how the system worked before I could decide what, if anything, to do about it. This, of course, was not why Lindsay and I had come to Hawaii. We hadn't hauled all the way out to paradise just so I could throw our lives away for a principle. We'd come to start over yet again. My doctors told me that the climate and more relaxed lifestyle in Hawaii might be beneficial for my epilepsy, since lack of sleep was thought to be the leading trigger of the seizures. Also, the move eliminated the driving problem. The tunnel was within bicycling distance of a number of communities in Kunia, the quiet heart of the island's dry, red interior. It was a pleasant 20-minute ride to work through sugarcane fields in brilliant sunshine. With the mountains rising calm and high in the clear blue distance, the gloomy mood of the last few months lifted like the morning fog. Lindsay and I found a decent-sized bungalow-type house on Ilu Street in Waipahu's Royal Kunia, which we furnished with our stuff from Columbia, Maryland, since Dell paid relocation expenses. The furniture didn't get much use, though, since the sun and heat would often cause us to walk in the door, strip off our clothes, and lie naked on the carpet beneath the overworked air conditioner. Eventually, Lindsay turned the garage into a fitness studio, filling it with yoga mats and the spinning pole she'd brought from Columbia. I set up a new Tor server. Soon, traffic from around the world was reaching the internet via the laptop sitting in our entertainment center, which had the ancillary benefit of hiding my own internet activity in the noise. One night during the summer I turned 29, Lindsay finally prevailed on me to go out with her to a luau. She'd been after me to go for a while because a few of her pole fitness friends had been involved in some hula girl capacity, but I'd been resistant. It had seemed like such a cheesy, touristy thing to do and had felt somehow disrespectful. Hawaiian culture is ancient, although its traditions are very much alive. The last thing I wanted was to disturb someone's sacred ritual. Finally, however, I capitulated. I'm very glad I did. What impressed me the most was not the luau itself, though it was very much a fire-twirling spectacle, but the old man who was holding court nearby in a little amphitheater down by the sea. He was a native Hawaiian, an erudite man with that soft but nasal island voice, who was telling a group of people gathered around a fire the creation stories of the island's indigenous peoples. The one story that stuck with me concerned the 12 sacred islands of the gods. Apparently, there had existed a dozen islands in the Pacific that were so beautiful and pure and blessed with fresh water that they had to be kept secret from humanity, who would spoil them. Three of them were especially revered: Kane Hunamoku, Kahiki, and Pauliuli. The lucky gods who inhabited these islands decided to keep them hidden because they believed that a glimpse of their bounty would drive people mad. After considering numerous ingenious schemes by which these islands might be concealed, including dyeing them the color of the sea or sinking them to the bottom of the ocean, they finally decided to make them float in the air. Once the islands were airborne, they were blown from place to place, staying constantly in motion. At sunrise and sunset, especially, you might think that you'd noticed one, hovering far at the horizon. But the moment you pointed it out to anyone, it would suddenly drift away or assume another form entirely, such as a pumice raft, a hunk of rock ejected by a volcanic eruption, or a cloud. I thought about that legend a lot while I went about my search. The revelations I was pursuing were exactly like those islands, exotic preserves that a pantheon of self-important, self-appointed rulers were convinced had to be kept secret and hidden from humanity. I wanted to know what the NSA's surveillance capabilities were exactly, whether and how they extended beyond the agency's actual surveillance activities, who approved them, who knew about them, and, last but surely not least, how these systems, both technical and institutional, really operated. The moment I'd think that I spotted one of these islands, some capitalized code name I didn't understand, some program referenced in a note buried at the end of a report, I'd go chasing after further mention of it in other documents, but find none. It was as if the program I was searching for had floated away from me and was lost. Then, days later or weeks later, it might surface again under a different designation, in a document from a different department. Sometimes I'd find a program with a recognizable name, but without an explanation of what it did. Other times, I'd just find a nameless explanation, with no indication as to whether the capability it described was an active program or an aspirational desire. I was running up against compartments within compartments, caveats within caveats, suites within suites, programs within programs. This was the nature of the NSA. By design, the left hand rarely knew what the right hand was doing. In a way, what I was doing reminded me of a documentary I once watched about map making, specifically about the way that nautical charts were created in the days before imaging and GPS. Ship captains would keep logs and note their coordinates, which land-bound map makers would then try to interpret. It was through the gradual accretion of this data, over hundreds of years, that the full extent of the Pacific became known, and all its islands identified. But I didn't have hundreds of years or hundreds of ships. I was alone, one man hunched over a blank blue ocean trying to find where this one speck of dry land, this one data point, belonged in relation to all the others.